Welcome, everyone. I think we'll start on time here. Welcome to session number 306. This is Beyond Allied Professions, When You're the Archivist and the Librarian. This session explores the hybrid terrain that many archivists find themselves in, that of being both an archivist and a librarian. These Lone Rangers help us to navigate their worlds and the borders that they go beyond in their daily work. They explore the challenges and, yes, the opportunities that they find in their positions. This session will offer those in archival settings of all kinds, but Lone Ranger shops in particular, encouragement and insight. Jenny Freed will explore how she made the archives in a small-town public library come to life. Amy Jankowski will describe the successes that she's had with InReach at the San Diego Zoo Global. Rachel Grove Rohrbaugh will illustrate how her librarian duties at a small college have spelled success for her archives. Rachel Grove Rohrbaugh, has been the archivist and the public services librarian at Chatham University since 2008. She holds a BA in art history from the University of Delaware and an MLIS with a specialization in archival studies from the University of Pittsburgh. She became a certified archivist in 2010. Rachel has previously published articles on archival ethics and outreach and is an active member of SAA and MARAC. Jenny Freed most recently was the archivist special collections librarian at the Vespasian Warner Public Library. I'm going to get all my pronunciations correct today. At the Vespasian Warner Library in Clinton, Illinois. She received her undergraduate degree from Carleton College and holds an MLS and Certificate in Special Collections from the University of Illinois and an MA in History from Illinois State University. In the fall, she will be teaching American History at Illinois State University. She is an active member of ALA, SAA, and MAC. Amy Jankowski is the assistant librarian at the San Diego Zoo Global Library, where she works primarily as a loan arranger with the library's archives and rare book collection. She holds a BA in anthropology from the University of Illinois and an MLS with an archives and records management specialization from Indiana University. In her years as a student, she worked in various capacities in museum and archives environments. She is an active member of national and regional professional organizations and is currently serving leadership roles in SAA, including San Diego Committee, San Diego Host Committee member, thank you very much, this year, and SLA. And I'm Allison Stancroft, and I'm the archivist at Indiana University South Bend, and I'm a loan arranger and a librarian also. So I look forward to hearing your talks.
Hi, I'm Rachel Grove Rohrbaugh, and the title of my presentation today is The Adaptable Information Professional, Combining Library and Archival Expertise to Serve Diverse Patron and Collection Needs. And I'll be speaking from the academic library perspective on the dual archivist librarians. All right. In an article published earlier this year, Mary Manning and Judy Silva reported that academic archivists with library responsibilities most frequently cite time, as in time to complete all of their work, as their biggest professional challenge. On the other side of the coin, this same group of dual archivist librarians noted that outreach, promotion, and interactions with faculty and main library staff are the most prominent benefits of their hybrid positions. So true are these challenges and benefits to my own experiences. I repeatedly found myself wondering, as I read the article, if I was one of Manning and Silva's anonymously quoted survey respondents. Working as a loan arranger in a small university library, lack of time and a troublesome workload will continually be a hurdle, but I am constantly surprised by the positive results of combining library and archival duties, particularly the opportunities for outreach and interaction this situation provides. Most rewarding is the freedom and flexibility this dual role affords me to apply my skills to the task at hand. A frequent argument for library, archive, and museum collaboration is that users do not care who manages the resources, they just want access to them. My work as a dual archivist librarian helps me see this broader picture and adapt to diverse patron and collection needs. Chartered in 1869 as Pennsylvania Female College, my employer, Chatham University, is one of the oldest women's colleges in the United States. The majority of the university's approximately 2,300 students are in co-educational graduate programs, but the undergraduate college remains single-sex. Situated in a largely residential section of urban Pittsburgh, several campus buildings were originally the private homes of prominent individuals. The most notable is the university's administrative building, which was the estate of Andrew W. Mellon and features landscaping by the renowned Olmsted Brothers firm. And that's the image there on the right. The campus also includes the oldest surviving residence from Pittsburgh's Millionaires Row, the Howe Childs Gatehouse, which was built in the 1860s. And the image on the left there is it circa 1860. Since 2008, Chatham has also held a second campus north of the city, the 388-acre Eden Hall Farm, which was founded as a retreat for the retired and working women of the H.J. Hines Company. Chatham is currently developing the Eden Hall campus into the home of a school of sustainability and the environment. This new campus and school will continue Chatham's commitment to environmental responsibility, women's leadership, and global understanding, all central to the university's educational mission. In late 2005, just a few months after earning my bachelor's degree, I began my career at Chatham as a paraprofessional. The majority of my early duties were strictly library-related, namely interlibrary loan, reference, and collection development. My previous experience was as a work-study assistant in an art history slide library, and then later as a volunteer at the Pennsylvania State Archives, so traditional library work was almost completely new to me. All the same, I had moved to the city with the intention of soon entering the Archival Studies MLIS program at the University of Pittsburgh, and was happy to find a job that would not only pay the bills while I was in graduate school, but also help me build my resume. As is still the case, Chatham's library has only 6 full-time staff members, but the atmosphere was supportive and collegial. The encouragement of my coworkers, all professional librarians, made it easier to ask questions and learn from their example. I soon learned that the library's basement housed the college archives, but as too often the case at smaller institutions like Chatham, the archives had never been managed by a professional full-time archivist. Alumni of the Women's College had been collecting historic materials since at least the 1830s, and a former English professor had worked with the materials from 1987 to 1993. But in recent years, the task of handling the archives had largely fallen to the library staff. One particularly dedicated reference librarian had attempted to bring organization to the chaotic storage space, but at the unfortunate expense of original order. There were, however, several positives to the situation in the archives. The library had secured grant money to process collected materials by and about noted environmental writer Rachel Carson, who graduated from the college in 1929, and they had a dedicated website for the Carson Collection Finding Aid. That's Carson right there as a young woman on the campus in 1926. The archives also benefited from a 2003 Getty Foundation Campus Heritage Grant to conduct a building and landscape stewardship study, which facilitated the organization of the college's architectural plans. Another positive was the establishment of a small endowment to pay for supplies and special projects in the archives. This endowment made possible Chatham's initial contribution of digitized images to Historic Pittsburgh, a collaborative online resource created by a number of local institutions. In the 3 years I worked at Chatham as a paraprofessional librarian, I did some processing and inventorying in the archives, but my involvement was minimal. My time at Chatham was primarily spent learning the skills of librarianship, which I was not gaining in my heavily archives-focused course of study at the University of Pittsburgh. In my library work at Chatham, I learned the art of the reference interview, the ins and outs of our subscription databases, and the politics of consortial borrowing. I enjoyed this job, and despite my limited formal training, Chatham's library director has commented that she has always seen me as a librarian first and foremost. The convergence of library staff changes and my graduation from Pitt led to my promotion as Chatham's solo archivist in late 2008. I felt incredibly lucky to have found a full-time professional position in an increasingly sour job market, but I was also overwhelmed by what I was facing: a lack of policies and procedures, a tremendous backlog, a largely uncatalogued rare book collection, and a steady stream of archives reference questions. Meanwhile, my promotion had not added any staff hours to the library, and I was still expected to cover several reference desk shifts, pitch in on library instruction, and continue my faculty liaison responsibilities. Nearly 4 years later, I still fret over that backlog, but I'm also pleased with everything we have accomplished. The relationship I built with my fellow librarians and Chatham's faculty have created numerous opportunities for collaboration and integration of library and archival services. I work closely with the library's head of technical services, and he has helped me catalog the rare book collection and get more archival records into the OPAC. We also share our knowledge on AV conversion and preservation, electronic theses and dissertations, and a planned institutional repository. With his help, the Archives and Special Collections page also found a prominent place on the library's new website. My collaboration with Chatham's two reference librarians has also been very rewarding. Both are focused on improving information literacy and the effectiveness of library instruction. Early on, the majority of my outreach was to history faculty and the landscape architecture students who were already using blueprints in the archives. With the librarians' encouragement, I looked for ways to work with additional departments. I began offering a workshop for faculty on teaching with primary sources and scoured the course schedule for any class that might benefit from archival instruction. In a 2010 survey of American history faculty, Doris Malkmus found that college teachers often want to use more primary sources in their instruction, but frequently lack the time or ability to find these resources. With this in mind, I looked beyond Chatham's own archives and special collections and marketed myself to my library colleagues as the expert on locating primary sources online and in other local repositories. Whenever the reference librarians met with a student who seemed to need help finding primary sources, they would suggest an appointment with me. Frequent referrals of graduate food studies students led me to co-teach a session with the librarians and create a food history research guide. I also offered to teach a unit on finding online primary sources to a class in an education department for students studying to become high school history teachers. Generally, I find it easy to wear my librarian and archivist hats, and I feel comfortable suggesting both primary and secondary sources relevant to a student's research. There have been a number of other benefits to my relationships with Chatham's librarians, particularly in the areas of outreach and promotion. The archives regularly contributes to the library's blog. There's a post on the left there from our May Day celebrations. our Facebook page, and when I recently presented a small archival exhibition around the 50th anniversary of the publication of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, a librarian created an accompanying display of books by Carson that visitors could check out. Librarians have also helped me advocate for donations and transfers to the archives. When a long-tenured professor recently retired, his positive relationship with his liaison librarian eased the collection of his papers. My work in Chatham's archives and special collections has likewise strengthened my own liaison relationships with faculty members. After I helped an English professor find rare books in our collection related to his own research, he became more receptive to my requests for input on new databases and books for the circulating collection. As Tamar Chute has commented on her writing on outreach in college and university archives, a small environment like Chatham's makes it easier to work more closely with individual faculty and staff members. My work as a librarian has further improved my ability to make the archives, or at least the archivist, more visible on campus. Thinking like a librarian also keeps me service-oriented and helps me better focus my efforts in the archives. I try to choose processing projects that will see the most immediate research use and prioritize prompt access over meticulous description. MPLP is a harried dual archivist librarian's best friend. Towards the conclusion of their article, Manning and Silva comment on the stress that dual archivist librarians face and ask, can these information professionals be successful in fulfilling their institutional missions while juggling so many responsibilities? I certainly struggle with this question and am constantly looking for ways to stay sane and make more efficient use of my time. I also try to focus on the positives of this arrangement and relish the variety in my everyday work. As the dual role persists and conceivably grows, I hope we can continue to learn from each other and capably serve our patrons and our collections as both archivists and librarians. So just a quick thank you to my co-presenters and all my wonderful co-workers at Chatham University. They made me a librarian. Pitt made me an archivist, and they made me a librarian. And just a little bibliography, and a little more bibliography. And that's it. And now we're going to hear from Jenny Freed about archives and library work in a public library environment.
So I'm going to be talking about the hidden collection archives in small public libraries. And I'm short, so I'm going to push that down a bit. The Vespasian Warner Public Library is located in Clinton, Illinois, a rural farming community with a population of 7,400. It is the former home of a Revereware factory, which manufactured copper cookware, and the current home to Clinton Power Station, one of Exelon's newest nuclear power plants. Clinton fits the stereotype of small-town America, where people judge you based on whether or not they knew your grandparents, and where there is absolutely nothing to do on a Friday night. Like so many other rural communities, Clinton has fallen on hard times. There is high unemployment, and most of the residents are low-income and undereducated. All of this makes it all the more extraordinary that the local public library has an archive and rare book collection. One of the earliest residents of Clinton was Clifton Haswell Moore, who arrived in August of 1841 at the age of 24. Moore was a lawyer and land speculator. His business partner and best friend, Judge David Davis, was the judge on the 8th Judicial Circuit, Abraham Lincoln's campaign manager in the 1860 presidential election, and Lincoln's first appointee to the Supreme Court. Moore was also friends with Lincoln and shared his law office with the future president when Lincoln was in DeWitt County. Moore, an avid book collector, had the largest and most valuable private book collection in Illinois outside of Chicago in the 19th century. He primarily collected literature and history, although he also had an interest in religion and science, particularly the Mormons in terms of religion. His oldest book was a copy of the New Testament, published in 1600, and the library's original card catalog indicates he owned a first edition of the Book of Mormon. When Moore died in 1901, he left his collection to the city of Clinton with the stipulation that they had to build a library to house it. Vespasian Warner, what a name, Moore's son-in-law and former law partner, as well as a United States congressman and the commissioner of pensions under President Teddy Roosevelt, paid for the library's construction in 1906. The library's doors opened in 1908, and C.H. Moore's books were the library's first circulating collection. Warner also gave the library a substantial endowment, which has kept it afloat in difficult economic times. Now, every archival position comes with its own unique set of challenges. Finding creative ways to deal with those challenges can be an endless source of frustration and excitement. Since my own area of interest is special collections, library school did not entirely prepare me for what I faced. I had always planned to work in an academic setting, but the current economic situation made it difficult to find such a position, and when I was offered a job at the Warner Library, I jumped at the opportunity. Academic and public libraries certainly have their similarities, but the communities they serve are different. Numerous articles and books note that public libraries tend to be gathering places for local residents, safe havens for those in need, a place to obtain information on local issues, and a source of entertainment. In addition, unlike academic institutions, public libraries are often much more interested in collecting high-demand materials such as popular fiction, movies, and most recently, e-books. Collecting materials for research and scholarly pursuits would be a waste of the library's money since few would use them. This makes it all the more difficult to justify the existence of an archive within a small public library's hierarchy and budget. These types of collections tend to be described as hidden collections, which Gwen Glazer defines as being undiscoverable by scholarly users, either through digital or analog means. In Glazer's article, Digitizing Hidden Collections in Public Libraries, she goes on to say that, quote, such hidden collections are under threat because they are vulnerable to accidents, theft, and neglect, end quote. And this was certainly the case when I arrived at the Warner Library in 2009. The archive and rare book collections were in complete chaos. The materials were in no particular order and covered in thick layers of dust, and that was one of the nicer things they were covered in. The collection, like so many others across the country, had been neglected. As Kathy Marquis states in her article, Historical Collections is Adding One Right for Your Public Library, these types of collections can, quote, provide a useful set of research materials for local researchers, or they can be a special collection, which no one is sure how best to handle, and so it remains unused. In my experience, it is often the latter. I know of one small public library that, until a few years ago, stored its archival materials under the sink in the staff lounge. Life at the Warner Library was a balancing act. I was frequently left alone, spending my days sorting the archival materials so I could process them, cleaning and organizing and cataloging Moore's rare book collection, of which around 5,000 volumes remained, creating policies for researchers and for collection development, writing the disaster plan, and advertising the collection to the community, which had, for the most part, forgotten about it long ago. In addition, the collection turned out to be far more diverse than I had originally anticipated. It was more than just books and documents. There were extensive photograph and postcard collections, original artwork from the Works Projects Administration, and an enormous collection of Revereware pots and pans, including some prototypes. Sometimes, as I discovered, the archivist is also the museum curator. Outreach was one of my main priorities. If I wanted to make the collection relevant, to justify its existence and future maintenance, I had to make the community care about it. It has become fairly standard in the library and archival communities to use the internet to connect with researchers, but this was not possible given my community's economic situation. Many people in Clinton do not have personal computers or internet access. Instead, I focused on more traditional methods. I appeared on the radio and at the request of our local genealogical society and the historic society in Decatur, Illinois, gave talks on C.H. Moore and the efforts we were making to preserve the rare book and archival collections. I also talked to patrons about preserving their family heirlooms in hopes that if they cared about their own treasures, they would understand the importance of preserving the libraries too. My biggest successes were exhibitions. The adult services librarian and I created two major exhibitions on DeWitt County in 2011, one to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, for which we won a Superior Achievement Award from the Illinois State Historical Society, and the other to honor the 70th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. We used the opportunity to display items from the archive and books in the circulating collections, but also asked members of the community to bring in their own treasures for display. We wanted the community to feel involved, something that is key in a public library setting. At first, we ran into a wall. Despite our best efforts, we had difficulty connecting with some of our patrons. For a variety of reasons, many people did not find out about the exhibition until after we opened, probably because they didn't have access to the internet. For others, I think there may have been a lack of trust. We had never done an exhibition before, and community members did not want to attach their names to something that might turn out to be a disaster. As a result, we received most of our artifacts for the Civil War exhibition after we opened. The World War II exhibition was easier. The local veterans, having seen our previous efforts, were thrilled to help us and eagerly provided us with items to display. A bonus was that I had finally managed to break through that small town barrier against outsiders. After all, I was born 30 miles to the north. People finally knew me, even though they did not know my grandparents, and donations and visits to the archive increased substantially after that. Local history enthusiasts became interested in our photograph collections, and one amateur Civil War historian loved our first edition set of The War of the Rebellion, a compilation of the official records of the Union and Confederate armies. Despite my extensive responsibilities in the archive, my work was often interrupted. Although my official title was Archivist and Special Collections Librarian, I also spent time participating in activities I had not been trained for. I was frequently called away from my desk to fill in elsewhere. Reference duties outside the archive are not unusual, but it does not mean the same thing in a public library setting as it does in an academic one. I had to become an expert on when the newest James Patterson or Daniel Steele novels were coming out. And just a hint, when in doubt, say next month and you'll probably be right. I had to become an expert on graphic novels and manga, which I had never read before. Twilight, which I could have done without. And The Hunger Games, which I did actually enjoy. I had to learn how to register people for library cards, how to collect child support and unemployment benefits from the state of Illinois, lead both adult and children's programs when their respective librarians were absent, and deal with the joys of bored teenagers. I think the key to working in this kind of environment is being open-minded and flexible. Within the public library setting, everyday library activities such as circulation, reference, and programming are considered more important than archival ones. Mary Manning and Judy Silva, in their article, Dual Archivist Librarians, suggest that this is the case in academic settings as well. When the library or archive is short-staffed, the general response is to close or limit access to the archive, not the other way around. It can be extremely frustrating to be called away to check out books when you have a collection you need to finish processing or rare books that need to be cataloged. As I learned, the archive is often seen as a status symbol for the library, not a necessity. There were many times when my role as librarian was of much more importance to the staff and directors than that of archivist. Sometimes you have to remind yourself that regardless of how you are spending your day, you are still serving a deserving public, and those people you help as the librarian may just remember when the time comes that you are also the archivist. And without further ado, we get to see the cute and fuzzies from the zoo.
Global conservation, education, recreation, preservation. Finding balance for work gone wild in a zoo library and archives. When one sets foot in San Diego, it is nearly impossible to avoid the reaches of the San Diego Zoo, a place that has grown to exemplify world-class animal care, research, and exhibition. However, the San Diego Zoo is just one branch of the nonprofit organization San Diego Zoo Global, or SDZG, as I'll refer to it throughout this presentation, which also includes the San Diego Zoo Safari Park, about 30 miles north of the city, and the San Diego Zoo Institute for Conservation Research, through which research scientists work on 125 local, regional, and global field projects in 35 countries on 6 continents. The present organization's breadth and esteem has humble origins. In 1916, local physician Dr. Harry M. Wegeforth set out to create the Zoological Society of San Diego, starting with the menagerie of animals left in town after San Diego's 1915 Panama-California Exposition. During the zoo's successive early years, an industrious bare-bones staff worked long hours to build and care for its animal collection. The organization often found itself hanging by a shoestring, starting projects before solidifying funding, but always progressing towards improving animal care, research endeavors, zoo facilities, marketing strategies, and educational programs. Through a series of ambitious zoo directors and curators, strong relationships in the zoological field, an amiable climate, high animal rearing success rates, and perhaps a bit of luck, the San Diego Zoo was able to establish itself as a major zoological garden worthy of imitation by the mid-20th century. Unfortunately, the organization's prowess did not extend to meticulous record-keeping or an eye for archival preservation. The documentary evidence that remains of the zoo's triumphs, failures, milestones, and daily operations accumulated in department offices and passed through various staff hands for many years without a clear archival direction, or management plan or preservation strategy. Materials eventually found a home within what is now the SDZG Library, which has supported the organization's needs since its early years. I came to SDZG in July of 2011, fresh out of graduate school with my MLS and a specialization in archives and records management. I was hired under the title Assistant Librarian, though my primary responsibilities focus on the library's archives and rare book collection. I'm the first employee with practical and theoretical archival training to take on the role of managing the organization's documentary history. Prior to my arrival, most materials in the archives were organized and described as artificially created collections with imposed order or cataloged as individual objects at a very basic level using a homegrown database. Based largely on the museum archive guidelines endorsed by SAA, my initial goals were to process, house, and describe the existing collections in line with professional archival standards, determine future collection strategies for both physical and digital records, and enliven interests of and use of the archives within the organization. Aside from its more obvious eccentricities, collections of animal horns, exotic eggshells, zookeeper diaries, and of course the infamous sausage grinder used to force feed snakes in the zoo's early days, the SDZG library has a number of qualities which set it apart fundamentally from many other traditional libraries and archives. One difference of note is that the library is not open to the public. Rather, it is much like a corporate facility focused on providing access to internal users. Though scholarly researchers are occasionally permitted to use portions of our collections on a case-by-case basis, the library exists primarily to meet the information needs of the organization's paid and volunteer staff, which includes up to 2,900 employees during peak seasons and over 1,000 volunteers annually. These individuals, from animal and plant care professionals to research scientists, educators, office personnel, and more, harbor a wide range of interests, though there exists a general theme in line with the organization's mission as a conservation, education, and recreation organization dedicated to reproduction, protection, and exhibition of animals, plants, and their habitats, which is quite a mouthful. Most library users are thus interested in newly published research or general life science information and rarely come seeking historical material, aside from periodic requests from the development and marketing departments. Given the library's limited staff, the library director, a half-time research assistant, and myself, My position also includes a range of library responsibilities to ensure that the department runs smoothly and effectively satisfies the needs of its steady user base. I organize my daily objectives around long-term projects, usually archival in nature, which fulfill my overarching professional goals. These projects are also interspersed with patron interactions, which require immediate attention, like reference and circulation, as well as other routine library functions when necessary. Through tasks such as basic research assistant, circulation, cataloging, and roving library reference trips serving zoo and park staff, I have had the opportunity to brush up on many foundational library skills that I regrettably overlooked as an information science student focused on preparing for work in the archives field. This varied work expands my skill set, helps break up my days, keeps me on my feet, and allows me to get to know patrons with whom I would otherwise not frequently interact as an archivist alone. Though the underpinnings of SDZG's organizational structure create a unique library and archives environment, many of the experiences of similar dual professionals are mirrored here, including outreach, promotion, and interactions with staff as significant benefits of duality. By learning more about SDZG employees, departmental responsibilities, research interests, and the daily workings of the organization, I am able to better inform a collecting strategy to develop the archives in coming years and envision ways to promote and enliven interest in historical collections, in addition to that attributed to library materials, which already experience a level of demand. One key aspect that I have already taken away from these experiences is recognition that the organization is in need of a solid electronic records management strategy for general administrative records as well as scientific research data, the latter of which is of particular interest within SDZG right now, because shared access to data is now required for compliance with National Science Foundation grant specifications. I see this as an opportunity to potentially involve the archives as a stakeholder in the formation of an institutional repository, which should prove invaluable for preservation of and access to digital media of all kinds. It would also provide an ideal opportunity to collaborate with a number of SDZG departments and further communicate the role of the library and archives' interconnected purpose, principles, and function within the organization. Given the SDZG library's status as an auxiliary department within a large organization where very few people inherently understand the purpose and functionality of archives, it was necessary to first consider how the archives fits within the organization's larger goals. I saw this as an important step in prioritizing activities and resources to bring the non-traditional repository in line with professional archival standards and trends. In an effort to impart more clarity, the director and I rewrote the organization's library and mission statements to better focus the underpinnings of our daily work and long-term objectives in tangent with those of SDZG as a whole. I often look back on these statements when considering processing priorities and envisioning creative ways to work around organizational and budgetary constraints. In addition, policy writing, investigating organizational workflows, learning about interdepartmental relationships, and hierarchically mapping out goals have put me on the right track to understanding the organization and moving forward to create plans for the future. Due to organizational sensitivity, one particular challenge in my work is sharing archival documents and information beyond our visiting users. Similar to practices in some corporate repositories, SDZG filters all outgoing communication through the public relations department for the sake of maintaining a unified brand image. Therefore, outreach strategies popular in the archives field at large that focus on expanding access for a geographically dispersed user base are currently not permitted by SDZG, which includes all types of social media, open access to digital content, and also consortial finding aid databases. Instead of focusing on what I cannot do, I try to focus on what I can do, and have found ways to reach users through small in-house and digital exhibits, historical spotlight articles and newsletters, open houses, cooperation with the social media team, and even just talking casually about collections to spread awareness. Of course, I also see big opportunities to rouse archival interest in conjunction with the organization's upcoming centennial in 2016. Being a new professional and a loan arranger, tasked with both archival and library responsibilities in a non-traditional library and archives environment, I discovered very quickly that there is still much to learn after graduate school. Consequently, I continue to acquire help in furthering both my archives and library skills through various professional organizations, networking in the community, as well as through online and local workshops and webinars. I have a list of some of my favorites. There are almost too many to keep up with. You know, there's multiple things you could do every week, and these links will be available in my PowerPoint online later on. In addition, I found immense support through mentor relationships, both organic and those arranged through programs such as SAA and ALA. Also local groups like the California Library Association and other regional groups often have programs like this. Through invaluable resources such as these, I'm continually reminded that though I may occasionally feel out in the wilds of library and archive work, the information field is bursting with accessible resources and friendly faces willing to lend guidance and diverse experiential wisdom so long as one goes out to seek it. And in closing, I just love to thank my collaborators, my supervisor, and SDZG for providing all the great animal images for my presentation. And that is it. Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to open up for questions. Yes, please. So I'm going to recap your question and correct me if I'm getting any detail wrong. So you are local, and you're both a librarian and an archivist in two settings. Right. The essence of your question is this, right, that you're wondering how to balance reference and caring for the library collections. Okay, I'll let our speakers.
I will say it's always great to, as soon as you, especially email reference, when you get a request in, send them an email as quickly as you can, saying I'm not going to get to this right away, and give them sort of a time frame for what you think you can accomplish and when they can follow up. And I will say, too, with combining the two, it's always great because, at least in the academic setting, I work with a lot of students and faculty that have questions that are related to the archives or special collections, but there's this whole range of secondary resources that they maybe didn't even consider. And in some cases, they really need to look at those secondary resources before they even dig into the archives or special collections. So that can actually also be a way to give you a little time to prepare for them, to say, hey, maybe you should look at this book or this article first, and then we'll follow up in a few days. So that's one thing that I've found that's helpful.
Yeah, I mean, my experience is pretty similar. I guess what we just practice at my organization is if something is really, you know, needed sooner than something else, then that's prioritized, and just to always give people a time frame of when you might be able to help. Because everyone usually understands that if you are the archivist and the librarian, like, it's a tough thing to keep up with, and usually if you are polite and explain the situation, they're receptive. I've also found it helpful to, like, maybe find a little bit of information on their topic, like, you know, maybe through your subject files or something like that, if you have a collection like that, and then to dig deeper later on when you're less pressed for time.
Yes. So just to recap, The question is coming from another academic archivist, and she's found great success as a subject library liaison and good relationship building, but it has meant that she's seen increased donations,
And while a wonderful thing, it means that she has more backlog. So the question primarily is for Rachel, and I can speak to this as well for my role, is how do you balance that with your time load already strained?
I would definitely say that that's a wonderful thing to have, you know, more donations. I know in my case, because there wasn't an archivist before, no one really even knew. They hadn't considered, you know. I actually also recently was able to distribute my collection development policy to all the department heads on campus. So immediately I got, you know, a flood of emails. So does this apply? Oh, I've got this, I've got that. But any event, I would definitely say that having a good accessioning system in place is going to be really helpful, because then I know I've been using Archon to, you know, just get a record into the system for the collections. And then I think you can even also put a sort of processing priority, like low or high, in there. And then that at least gets you a record in the system. You know what you have. And then, you know, as time allows, you can actually dig into the processing. I know one great thing about being in an academic setting is you're more likely to have student workers to help with processing. So I do that a lot, and end up doing more of the instruction and the reference myself. Did you have anything else to say about that, Allison?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I've definitely had that experience myself, and I'm a subject liaison librarian now to four departments. And what I've done is I've created opportunities for students, because we don't have a library science program at my campus, particularly for history students. And I've gotten a lot of volunteers, and obviously that's a little bit of a time thing to manage volunteers, because I have one part-time student worker as well position. But it's meant that I have a rotating clock of student workers consistently, and that's fantastic. And my faculty, you know, they keep sending me bright minds, so that's really great. So, any other questions? Yes. So just to recap, speaking to archival students and new professionals, if you're wanting to be in a solo archivist setting where you might be a hybrid like this, how does one prepare for a position like this? And particularly for Amy, too, to speak about her experience.
I know for my own position, the reason I was hired was because of my archival interests and training. So the library part of my work is kind of secondary. So I would say that I don't regret my educational experience at all. And you only have so many classes you can take during library school. So I would say to focus on what you're really passionate about. But also in school, I know IU has a great, the IT department does free classes on different computer software platforms and things like that, which is also a great help to get more web programming skills and stuff like that. So just take advantage of whatever you can to expand your skill set. And in terms of continuing education, there are just so many great resources out there for information professionals, both archival and library resources. Just Googling around, I've found a lot. And being on listservs, you see different things passing through all the time. You know, there have been some excellent preservation webinars run by the Library of Congress this year and some other organizations that have been a really great way to brush up on things and to try to fill in holes where you feel you want some more experience. Also, I know a lot of people have great success with programs like the Western Archives Institute. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but it's like an intensive two-week course that they offer every year, that people get really great archival training. in if that's something your school doesn't offer.
I found, because working in a small public library, I didn't really have access to as much. I was about an hour and a half from the University of Illinois, and they received various grants to offer free workshops, usually aimed at people like us who were fulfilling these dual roles. And I just tried to get on listservs and things that were telling me about these free educational opportunities. And if it was something that I could attend and my library was willing to pay at least my gas money or something like that, I would take advantage of those even if I didn't necessarily think I had an immediate need for it. I figured the notes I would take would still be beneficial. And also just networking, getting on the listservs, asking people, what do I do? I had a friend who was a museum curator, so I was constantly asking her, what do I do? And we would exchange. I'd tell her what to do with her archival materials, and she'd tell me what to do with her museum objects. And so, really, I think people are sometimes your best way of continuing education.
I would definitely reiterate that, the people aspect. I know in my particular case, I do live in an urban area, so reaching out to other librarians and archivists in my area was helpful. But then also, as I mentioned in my talk, being willing to ask my coworkers, I think probably the most intensive and helpful experience I've had is with our cataloger, our head of tech services, because I did not learn book cataloging. We did MARC records for archival collections, so it wasn't completely foreign. But I would also try to take that as an opportunity to also educate, because we usually have interns from the library school. So I would sit down, all three of us, so then while I was learning, the intern could learn as well, so I could sort of say that it was a doubly wonderful learning experience for everyone. But yeah, definitely reaching out to coworkers and to other people in your community, and not being afraid to say that I don't know how to do something.
And I reiterate all of that with my experience too. Are there other questions that people have? Yes. So just to reiterate, this is coming from another academic archivist, and she's wondering for Rachel, if Rachel has experienced any pushback from the administration in terms of being the first archivist and creating an archives.
I will say that because I had been working there previously as a paraprofessional, I was someone that was familiar, so they got to know me. I think across the board, a lot of administrators and faculty at many academic institutions don't really understand the training that goes into being a librarian or an archivist. So that's always going to be a communication to justify why you're there and why you're helpful. I know in the case of administration, sometimes they also just see the archives as sort of fun show and tell kind of, and don't see the actual administrative advantages. So being on top of how records management is handled at your institution and how you can actually benefit the institution in that very critical sense is very important. One silly thing, I know early, I think in the first month or so that I was working, I had a faculty member approach me about getting involved in a grant project that he wanted to digitize a whole collection that I knew was actually mostly secondary sources and didn't really, it wasn't a good candidate for digitization. And he said in the course of the conversation, what is your training exactly? And I felt, hey there, that's not very nice of you to say. But it prompted me to put MLIS after my name in the signature of my emails, just so little things, just to push people and remind them that, hey, I really wanted to be here. I want to help you, and I want to do this, and I'm not an amateur. I'm here to get things done. So.
And I'll just second in terms of
my experience. My position was created because, like Rachel, I was the first archivist at my campus in 10 years. And previous to that, there had been an archivist for 2 years, and that's it. Accreditation. Accreditation is what was the linchpin. I will be put my institution out there. We almost didn't make our accreditation in the year 2000, and my library dean had been asking for funding for the position for about 4 or 5 years. So when we almost didn't make accreditation because we couldn't pull together across the campus the documents that were needed, she said, "Now do you see why we need this position?" So accreditation, you can push that to your administrators all the time to really strengthen why your position and your archives are so critical to the campus. Other questions? Yes, in the way back. Okay, to recap, a very helpful hint, particularly for those who might be newer in the profession, and that is a great way to keep in contact with your patron base, and that is to make note of the person, their information needs, jot down what they need, and keep in contact with them, even if it's months and months later, and that way you can be organized. And, yeah, as you find information, and keep in contact with them.
I would also say that's a good tip for any of you out there, that even if you're not a dual archivist librarian, but if you're a reference archivist, is keeping a good record of the questions that you've previously answered and the contact information, because the other thing that's going to happen is people are going to ask the same question as a previous researcher, so having a record of those is great. Looks like we have another question out here.
Yes.
So to recap that, this is another an expansion on that last helpful tip, and that's coming from a public library setting, and I think it's applicable to all of us in whatever setting we are, and that is to keep a list of facts, people, places, and things that you get very frequently, and you can have answers that you give out very easily, and then that gets the patron started, and then you that's a doorway into and a conversation that you can have with those folks about further resources down the road. Yes. And this was a follow-up to have files like that. It helps us as information professionals, that collegial relationship with our patrons, and it also strengthens our knowledge of our collections. Any other questions or thoughts? I love these ideas that we can take back to our shops, too. That's really helpful for all of us, I think. Anything else that folks want to contribute or say or ask? Yes. And a further point about how to justify yourself to your higher-ups, whoever they may be, and that is to emphasize how the archives can save the institution money, that we really are effective and important units of the whole, because especially in these times. Yes. And another good point about on the money tip, and that is that we serve an important role as working with donors, and you know that is, I think, more than possibly other units of an institution, whether it's an academic or another kind of institution, is that we have close ties with donors, and that can bring money in too. Yes. So this is the point about support groups, like friends groups, and nurturing those relationships with that group, because they can be ambassadors and they can also be supports in more ways than one to our institutions. Good point. Anybody else? Okay, well, thank you so much for attending our session.